Radio Land. I'm Mark, and I'm drinking at KJ's in Morris, Illinois, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, geez, I got excited too. Thank you, Mark. That was a lovely introduction. I appreciate that. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. So happy to be with you today, broadcasting live from the Allstate Skyline Studio in downtown Chicago. This is show number 627. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Be sure to say hi online or whatever else you want to say. Just keep it, you know, keep it cool, keep it respectful. Colin shaking his head. We have a Facebook account. Yes, we do. Just search for Outside the Loop Radio. You could say on Twitter.
Are you all right, Mike?
I don't know.
What are you saying today, man?
I'm just saying you can say hi to us.
You can.
There are a lot of avenues that you can do that.
But hey, keep it clean, buddy.
Right, I feel like we're in your classroom or something.
Yeah, keep it clean. I have to say, keep it school appropriate.
Right? I like that.
Keep it school appropriate. I guess you don't have to keep it school appropriate, but, you know, I mean, look, let's all just get along, can't we?
It's a little tough, though. If you guys don't want any problems, keep it school appropriate.
Yeah? Keep it school appropriate, or else I'll take you out on a bike rack.
Exactly.
What do we have? Twitter at Outside the Loop is the handle. Instagram, Outside the Loop Radio, and all that stuff. Hey, we've got so much to do on the program today. Little theme, you know, if we have to theme the show, sometimes we do. I think this just kind of happened. The theme is housing, houses, something to do with a house. That's kind of like the theme, because later in the program, we will talk about the history of a fair housing ordinance in Oak Park. This is the 50th anniversary of that suburb's fair housing ordinance, and they've got a really cool brand new museum exhibit to explore the history of fair housing. So that's something that Chicagoland has really been dealing with for a long time. It's pretty cool. I was there earlier this week, so we'll hear what that that report is all about and what that exhibit is all about. Also, we'll talk about how shifting wealth in households is impacting the fabric of Chicago. There's a new study that came out from the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul. And it's pretty interesting to see the shifts in wealth and who lives in these houses in certain neighborhoods in Chicago. And there's a brand new play out, and it's all about, well, it's kind of spooky because it's, first of all, it's for Halloween. And secondly, it features life-size puppets, which can just be creepy in and of itself. It's called The Walls of Harrow House. There's the house theme. It's at the Chopin Theater. It's going on right now. We will talk to the playwright and the director of that show. It's all coming up on the program today. We say hi to Colin Seaman, who produces the program, who I think is being very critical of my performance so far.
What's my job to be critical of your performance, Mike?
So is this going to show up in the post-show write-up?
This will show up in your formal evaluation. I want you to know that you are nowhere near distinguished right now. But that's okay. Distinguished is a place that we visit, Mike. It's not a place that we live.
We can't live in the distinguished realm, except if you're Domiti Pongo in the newsroom. He is quite the distinguished gentleman.
I am. I'd like to think so myself.
No, you are.
Good day. Ta-ta.
100%. Hey, really quickly, Colin, you weren't here last week, because you got things to do. I understand that. I know that you wanted to say something really quickly about the environment, because we talked about the environment last week. On last week's show, we discussed some environmental issues, and you weren't here because you love the environment so much. You weren't here to say anything about it.
Well, I wasn't here because of a wedding, but yes, that IPCC report that came out hit me pretty strongly.
On climate change.
Correct. And it just boggles my mind how this issue turns into some sort of partisan thing. There is no left and right on this side. It's like, do you have money in fossil fuels or don't you?
Right. And that's the thing. It's the earth, you know, depending on where you fall politically, we all need a place to live.
100%.
You know, and we all need air to breathe.
We cannot deny this anymore. Let's just make the changes. And the changes, as we talked with the fantastic lady last week, they need to be made on a top-down policy level. It is frustrating to read a report like that and feel like you as an individual can't make that much of a difference, but it's systems that need changes.
Yeah, right. And that's why policy is so great.
Right. But systems can also mean like your neighborhood.
Yeah.
Systems can mean the place that you work. Systems can mean like larger than yourself. So just start with that. And I would like my kids to see snow.
And you've got the ripple effects, too, in countries that are going to be hit really hard. You've got refugee crises that
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. To think that we're not all interconnected in this is quite naive.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I just think that it should be pushed to the forefront. I mean, like existence in general, whether that's existence with us as individuals or with us and our planet, like come the freak on, people.
Thank you for censoring yourself. I'm glad that. So did you get that?
School appropriate.
Keep it school appropriate. You got that off your chest. You feel good.
Yeah, we should get to the show.
Yeah,
we're
should
running
get
late.
Hey, you know what? For the first time ever, that's not because of me. That's not because of me, everybody. There it is. There it is. No, it's an important issue, and we will keep talking about it for sure here on this show because it's something that, you know, it's not like it's a change that's going to happen tomorrow or next year. This is a few years off, but when it does, when things start to finally change, we're going to say, I wish I did something. Wish we all got together and took this a little bit more seriously. Domati, on a happier note, is everything okay with you? I'm hoping that something is okay with you.
Everything is great.
All right, good.
I learned a new way to make coffee at the coffee machine, so I'm very happy. That's
here?
Why I sound a lot. Yes.
Wait, there's a new way to make coffee at the coffee machine? We just put the cup there and hit coffee.
Oh, no. It's bigger than that.
All right.
This is bigger than cups of coffee.
We got to talk off the air here.
Oh, yeah.
All right. This is very serious. We need to have an emergency show meeting during the break.
You'll thank me.
We will take a break.
I just wanted to note that I said the nice lady that we spoke to last week, that was Jennifer Walling of the Illinois Environmental Council.
Thank you, Colin.
Just wanted to clarify that. You can go listen to it on podcast form. It's a fantastic episode.
OutsideTheLoopRadio.com, WGNRadio.com.
OTL 626.
That's right. Subscribe to the podcast. You're listening right now to OTL number 627, 627 shows. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Steven right here on 720 WGN. And the local music that we are featuring on this week's show comes from the local band Alpine Subs. Now, wait a second. Alpine Subs, is this in reference to the great Alpine Deli on North Avenue in Elmwood Park? Because those sub sandwiches are just, it's beyond compare. They're the best. And I grew up on those things. AlpineSubs.bandcamp.com is the website. I hope this band is a nod to Alpine because Alpine is the greatest little deli that ever existed. Again, you can check out that website for more information on the band and for any gigs that they have coming up. I dig at those, some like garage, a little bit of psychedelic rock, produced right here in Chicago. Each week I love to feature local music, and this week we are hearing it from the Alpine Subs. Delicious. The issue of fair housing is really important, and it's something that Chicagoland has been struggling with over the years. There are certain municipalities who have passed fair housing ordinances just to ensure that people, all people, regardless of one's race, feel welcome in the community. The suburb of Oak Park is celebrating 50 years of its fair housing ordinance, and earlier this week, I stopped by a local museum to learn about the history of this ordinance. So right now, let's hear what that sounds like, starting with the sounds of Lake Street. It's a nice day here in Oak Park on Lake Street, and I'm in an old firehouse. And not just any old firehouse. This is the Oak Park River Forest Museum. This is an awesome
over 100-year-old building, was a firehouse, now is a really cool museum looking at the history of Oak Park and River Forest. And we're on the second floor, and we're sitting in an exhibit called Open House, The Legacy of Fair Housing. I'm here with Frank Lippo, who is the executive director of the Oak Park River Forest Museum, and Sarah Dougherty, who is an assistant professor in American history and public history at North Park University, and the co-curator of this exhibit. Sarah and Frank, thank you so much for having us over. Really quickly, this place is awesome. I mean, I didn't know this was here. It's this little like firehouse, and I think I've driven by it a bunch here on Lake Street. But there's a lot of history in this building.
Yeah, we just actually opened it up last fall. We were historically the Historical Society of Oak Park and River Forest, and we raised $1 million in private funding, put in geothermal, HVAC, all new electrical plumbing, et cetera. And we found the original bones of the building and the decor of the building, the original ceilings and floors. And it was kind of been a real joy discovery to rediscover the building. But we're even more excited about the fact that this new space, which is a 120-year-old space, but it's new now also, gives us a better platform for telling the stories of Oak Park and River Forest. Because I think a lot of people know of Oak Park and River Forest as being the place where Frank Lloyd Wright or Ernest Hemingway lived, or a place that's kind of a very liberal, diverse suburb compared to some suburbs. And so we have a chance to tell some of those stories in a different place here.
And literally, we're right next door to Chicago. So, I mean, this, I look at this, I mean, the L runs here, the Metro runs here. So we, this is very much, I think, part of the Chicago flavor. And what we're thinking about right now in this exhibit, this legacy of the Fair Housing Ordinance that was passed here in Oak Park 50 years ago. So this year, we're celebrating the 50th year of the Fair Housing Ordinance. And really, you know, Chicago, we've said it a million times, Chicago's a segregated city. And housing is a big issue in this region. But this exhibit explores fair housing. Oak Park wasn't the first place to pass a fair housing ordinance. But Sarah, I'll look to you on this. I mean, tell us why an exhibit like this, did you help put this together? What story does this tell?
This gives us the opportunity to not only look at the passage of this legislation itself, but look at the steps that Oak Park took to actually enforce it. And that's kind of the difference you see around the Chicagoland area. Many other communities were passing fair housing ordinances as well, but they didn't actually, it's just nice on paper, but they didn't do anything to see that it actually happens. So amidst kind of white flight and panic peddling and blockbusting that's happening all over Chicago's west side and south sides, where in the span of a decade, you have the Austin community completely flipping from 99.5% white to over 90% black, this is at the border of Oak Park. It's three blocks from where we're sitting right now, and there was a concern within the community. Some people thought that this could easily happen to Oak Park. So there were some that felt that they should take a proactive approach in looking at how to keep people here, but also welcome in new people. But this also was met with a lot of resistance as well. It wasn't like everyone is like, hello, welcome diversity.
That's one of the shocking things. I mean, I was walking through this exhibit and, you know, Oak Park's got that liberal progressive label. And the amount of resistance in this community to a fair housing ordinance to try to bring people from different races together. I mean, the resistance is a big part of the story, isn't it, here?
Oh, it really is. I mean, I think by the 1960s, it was almost forgotten by a lot of local people that here in Oak Park, from 1905 to 1930-ish, there was a small but vibrant black community. There was an African-American church here right in downtown Oak Park. And I think what happened as the years passed and that community kind of dispersed a little bit, there was the sense that this was an upper-middle class, you know, sort of white community. And I think a lot of people who are looking at, who live in the community, were afraid of that sort of white flight-like mentality and how that would affect them here. And I think we're still an imperfect community, though. And I think that's one of the things you'll see in this exhibit, is that we don't just paint a rosy picture. There were 10,000 people who signed a petition against fair housing at the time. Some of the trustees that voted for it got death threats. There's police in the audience when they passed it. It was a 5-2 vote. It wasn't unanimous. And in liberal Oak Park today, you know, a stereotypical community, people say, oh, well, I'm glad we're here. But I think in history, you got to say things can go back and forth.
And I think it was important to us that this story not start at 1968. You need to give some historical context and background so you can understand this was a community of contradictions. In the first room of the exhibit, yes, you do see evidence of this small yet vibrant Black community with the building of their church in 1905. But then a few panels over, you see that a family living outside of the established small Black community, home was firebombed in 1914. And right next to that, you see evidence of the Ku Klux Klan and women of the Ku Klux Klan having very active chapters in the 1920s in Omaha.
Which is crazy. The women Ku Klux Klan division, or whatever you call it, in Oak Park. You've got a certificate or something over
there. That's their official charter for the women of the Ku Klux Klan. They went by the pseudonym Willosis Club because they often had pseudonyms so you didn't actually know what you were looking at, which makes it really hard as a researcher when this has been my research for a decade to find them because they go by these code names. But we had a very vibrant chapter of over 350 members, and we have the records by weekly minutes for 5 years of their existence. And it seems that they were kind of the epicenter of Chicagoland Klan activity. You have a lot of women from other Klan chapters in the area coming to Oak Park to learn how to do the rituals, to learn how to be a Klanswoman.
So Sarah, I want to ask you, when we think about this exhibit, what is the legacy of this stuff? I mean, the exhibit called The Legacy of Fair Housing. So I want to ask you, what is the legacy? What are we living through right now?
I think one of the great things when you have an exhibit that's rooted in a historical topic, but it has a lot of relevance on our present time. A lot of things that we're talking about 50 years ago, we still see as issues in the community. And some of those issues around fair housing have broadened a little bit. Some of the community issues, such as the fact that we have a food pantry in Oak Park to support 200 families who kind of need those services in one of the most affluent school districts in the state, yet there's still a food pantry. What else? Affordability. Looking at that issue of seniors not being able to afford living in Oak Park or first-time buyers trying to buy in Oak Park. So now when we look at fair housing, it's more an issue of the base level to move into Oak Park is unattainable, and in a lot of ways we're pricing out diversity that way. The fact that we still have a housing center 15 years on, it's still very much needed.
I want to just make sure that everyone knows, Frank, that people can come here. This is open to the public. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah, sure. We're open regular public hours Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday from 11 to 4. So anytime between Wednesdays and Saturdays, you can come here. We're actually doing a lot of group tours, local school kids, Sarah's North Park University students, the idea of just having people come at other times. So if someone's interested, our website is very, very literal, oprfmuseum.org, oprfmuseum.org, and there's information on those hours will be there. And we'd love to hear from people. You know, on occasion, we get people who are out of town or so just not available Wednesdays through Saturdays. We'd love to do special tours as appropriate.
And there's like a fire pole hole that you can walk over. It's been like plexiglassed over because this is an old firehouse. It's freaky. You can see downstairs, but you can walk on it. The kids will love it. Frank Lippo, Executive Director of the Oak Park River Forest Museum, and Sarah Dougherty, Assistant Professor of American and Public History at North Park University and co-curator of this exhibit. Again, the exhibit called Open House, The Legacy of Fair Housing here at the Oak Park River Forest Museum. Thank you so much for having us over. This is great. Everyone should really come check it out. It's an awesome dive into history and very relevant today. So thank you so much.
It's been our pleasure. It's been my pleasure. I shouldn't speak for you, Sarah. I hope.
Hopefully, it was a pleasure, Sarah.
It was a pleasure.
Awesome. We've all heard that Chicago's population is declining, and that's been going on for a few years now, really since around 2013, and that's concerning. But another piece of this story is understanding changes in households, and this tells us about housing demand, and looking at the wealth level of households can really help us understand that demand. Jeff Smith is the executive director at the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul University. And recently, that organization released a report on household income shifts in Chicago's neighborhoods. And Jeff Smith joins us once again here on Outside the Loop. Jeff, welcome back to WGN. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks for having me back.
You bet. And I think this is a really important issue. And so I want to ask you just at the outset here, because you at the Institute for Housing Studies, you put out a lot of information specifically with this study. Why did you focus on the income shifts in Chicago neighborhood households?
Well, as you mentioned at during the introduction, you know, a lot of people, you know, focus on population as a key indicator of the health of the city or the health of the region. And that's not necessarily wrong, but, you know, we always try to look at some of the nuances in the data. And one of the key data points that that we continue to see and look at is household. Household is essentially an occupied housing unit. So as you see, you know, growth or decline in the number of households, that tells you a lot about demand for housing in the city. And then if you break that down at the neighborhood level, if a neighborhood is growing in terms of the number of households, that means you're seeing a growing demand for housing in that neighborhood. And in particular, if you're seeing a growing demand from higher income households, that tells you about, again, the types of housing that might be developed in that neighborhood, the changing housing costs or housing affordability in that neighborhood. So, understanding what that looks like and how that data breaks down at the neighborhood level tells us a lot about housing affordability and investment in the city.
Does this get us into the gentrification issue where you've got high income housing sort of displacing the low income?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the data, you know, you can see that pattern emerging pretty starkly across a number of communities. You know, we looked at every Chicago community area, and just to pull out a couple that where this pattern and the pattern I'm talking about is, you see essentially almost no change in total households at the neighborhood level, or maybe a small increase or a small decrease. But what you see is when you look at the composition of households by their income, you see a major growth in households earning more than $100,000 a year. So these would be higher income households, almost entirely replacing households that are earning less than $100,000 a year. So these would be sort of middle, moderate, and lower income households. So you're really seeing a dramatic shift in neighborhoods like Westtown, Lincoln Park, Lakeview, Albany Park, Logan Square. And that tells you a lot about sort of who's moving into those neighborhoods, how wealthy they are. And higher income households tend to demand certain kinds of housing. So they want, you know, certain amenities. And developers tend to respond to that growing demand by, you know, building certain types of housing, raising rents. And so that's really what we're seeing in those types of neighborhoods.
So we understand that there is this gentrification issue. It is accelerating, what you're saying. So if people who live in low income housing, or households, I should say, if they're pushed out, I guess the next question is, where are they going?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I think that the data would show that, you know, in a set of neighborhoods, and these are these sort of rising, these gentrifying neighborhoods, we can call them, where you see a big growth in high income households and a loss of low income, low, moderate, and middle income households, you're seeing that type of shift happening in other parts of the city. I mean, in the entire city of Chicago, you're seeing a loss. So it's not just in those neighborhoods, it's all across the city where you're seeing a loss of lower, particularly middle and moderate income households. And it's a good question of A, where they're going, and B, you know, why they're leaving. I think where are they going? In some cases, they might be going to the suburbs. In some cases, they might be going out of the region. In terms of why, I think, you know, that's the bigger question and maybe one of the bigger concerns from a policy perspective is that, you know, folks who are earning or middle income families, middle income households are not able to stay or not seeing the opportunity in the city for various reasons. And they're moving to other parts of the region or the country.
Yeah. And I think there is a bigger policy question here about why certain individuals are choosing to leave or are getting pushed out or feel like they're getting pushed out. And as you say in this report, you know, it's different in different neighborhoods. The reason why people are leaving, I think that's why this can get a little complicated is because there isn't necessarily one blanket statement we can say as to, oh, yeah, that's why people are getting pushed out or are choosing to leave.
Exactly. I mean, I think that in the neighborhoods we just talked about, it's really maybe an affordability question in a lot of cases where housing prices are going up because you're seeing growing demand from high income households and moderate income, middle income families are finding it more and more difficult to afford to stay in those neighborhoods. But there are other parts of the city where you're seeing population loss across the board. So it's not just low and moderate income households. It's also higher income households. In those neighborhoods, it's perhaps less a concern about housing affordability and more a concern of just general opportunity in those neighborhoods where families are just seeing that there's better opportunity for them in other neighborhoods in the city, other parts of the region, or other parts of the country.
So you've got this report, and again, you can go to housingstudies.org to check it out, along with all the other information you've got at the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul. What can the city of Chicago do with this information, or are they going to do anything with this data?
Yeah, so, I mean, the genesis of this report is really a bigger data project that we worked on with the city to create a bunch of data points or indicators to inform conversations that the city was convening with regional neighborhood stakeholders around future housing needs, around the next five-year housing plan for the city of Chicago. So this was a key data point that, among many, that were presented and discussed at these convenings. And what really emerged, one of the key takeaways I think that emerged, was that you need a range of different housing strategies and a range of different non-housing strategies in some neighborhoods to maintain or retain middle, moderate income families in rising cost neighborhoods, and also attract or keep folks in these neighborhoods that maybe lack opportunity. So I think that, you know, one of the things these types of data can help policymakers understand is that there's not necessarily a one-size-fits-all strategy, but there are multiple strategies that need to be targeted to neighborhoods based on their underlying conditions.
We have to look at the local level, and I think this report, among the other research that you've done at the Institute, really gets to that local factor about different communities, and I think that's how we are going to affect change and make sure that the character of these neighborhoods is great and inclusive for all Chicagoans, because it is an issue here that we are working through in the city. Check out, again, housingstudies.org. Jeff Smith is the executive director of the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul University. Jeff, thank you so much for talking to us today. You always bring a lot of information. It's important information and vital to the city's future. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
It's Halloween season, and if you're looking for a fun yet scary seasonal event, well, you should head over to the Chopin Theater. It's over at 1543 West Division Street in Chicago in Wicker Park, and you should check out the show called The Walls of Harrow House. It is, pretty scary during this Halloween season. Mike Olean is the director of that show. Claire Sachs is the co-playwright. And they are both on the line with us today here on Outside the Loop. Guys, welcome to the show. Nice to have you here.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
You bet. So here's why the show, I think, can be terrifying, is because the show is featuring puppets, but like really scary puppets that are life-size.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of sources of inspiration for this show, but one of them is that every show that we have made in the years preceding this, there's inevitably a moment in the rehearsal process when a puppet does something creepy, and we're like, well, like that doesn't fit in this show, but let's save that for a chance when we want to finally make a truly creepy puppet show. So we're busting out a lot of those tools now.
So we're talking creepy puppets. But this is also an interactive show. So tell us a little bit about what the Walls of Harrow House is all about, because it's a chance for us to like go in there, interact, move between rooms, and get really creepy with puppets.
Yeah, so just in terms of plot, it's relatively basic. It takes place in the home and studio of a fictional architect who, through, I guess, sort of hubris in design, has allowed a creepy mold to set in into the walls, and that mold has made these sort of monstrous transformations possible amongst the residents. So as audience members walk around, you'll sort of encounter sort of like human scale puppets who can sort of just like walk right up to you and speak with you. There's lots of sort of detached limbs and body parts and unexpected collages of body parts who work together to create one creature. They kind of just surround you with both the, I guess, their spooky movements and spooky story.
That's truly frightening. And spooky for sure. I'm wondering, Claire, you're the co-playwright for the show. So obviously part of this is written, but how does that work if this is an interactive show where there's interaction between these puppets and us, the audience, as we're moving through the space? How does that work in terms of scripting it or creating a show that, has some structure to it?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the show is more immersive than interactive. The difference being the story is happening all around you. You as an audience member are free to move through the space as your will and your interests lead you. But the story is happening in a pretty set way. So you are not, as an audience member, asked to have conversations with the characters. You're not, asked to suddenly start improvising a scene with a puppet, but the audience members are sort of an acknowledged part of the story. Their presence in the house is an essential part of the events unfolding. The play is made up of, I keep making sure I have to go back and count them. I mean, 30 or 40 different small scenes that happen all over the course of the hour in different rooms of the house. So as an audience member, you are set off on a course by one character at the beginning of the play, and then have a choice for the remainder of the evening whether to follow a character who you started with, or to, wander from room to room following a bunch of different characters, or to, spend the whole night in the kitchen and watch all of the scenes that take place in the kitchen.
So really there's some freedom as the audience member. You get to kind of choose where you want to go, which is pretty cool. The idea for this, I know that the Rough House Theater, which is the theater company that is putting this show on, I know that you have done through that theater company shows like this in the past featuring puppets, but also sort of performing in non-traditional spaces. Now, granted, the Chopin Theater is a theater, but I know that you've performed in non-traditional spaces as well. So you have a little bit of a history doing this through your theater company, don't you?
Yeah, this production is our first stab at creating an immersive work, but we try and make sort of all of our shows pretty modular and tourable. The idea being that, we want to reach audience members who don't necessarily think of themselves as theater people. Typically a lot of our work is geared towards being able to live in any kind of space. We've performed at punk houses or out of doors or in warehouses or, of course, plenty of theaters. The idea being that, to be surprised by a piece of theater is, just sort of a treat unlike any other. Nobody ever expects to, just sort of like randomly happen into a puppet show. Unless you're going to like a puppet theater and you know what to expect. But we like to engage folks who don't already necessarily engage with that kind of stuff. And the Haunted House is very much along the same vein. Even though it is happening in a theater space, it's our hope to be able to reach out to folks who, don't necessarily go to puppet shows on a regular basis or don't necessarily see theater every week. And so far, the turnout's been fantastic, and a lot of the people who've been showing out are people who are just sort of like into the macabre or spooky things or just having a good time and don't necessarily think of themselves as theatergoers.
On a scariness level here, what are we talking about? We shouldn't bring small children to this show, right?
No, I think no small children. We've been saying age 14 and up. I mean, it's not gory. Gore is not particularly our flavor. And I think it's more kind of unsettling and creepy than outright haunted house horror style scary.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool, especially for the Halloween season. Again, it's called The Walls of Harrow House, and it is right now at the Chopin Theater. That's at 1543 West Division in Chicago, right in the Wicker Park neighborhood. And you can go to roughhousetheater.com if you'd like more information or for tickets. The show is Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays, and it's running for a few weeks, right?
Until the beginning of November.
All right. So check it out at the Chopin Theater. Again, it's called The Walls of Harrow House. Perfect for this Halloween season. Mike Olian is the director of that show. Claire Sachs is the co-playwright. Thanks for talking to us this morning about this show, guys. Best of luck with it and keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop, show number 627 is in the books. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Colin for producing. Thanks to Domati for doing news. And Bob Ferguson is our engineer. I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop on 720 WGN.